Welcome to the third episode of the Harry Potter Lexicon podcast. This is Steve Van Der Ark, the creator and editor-in-chief of the Harry Potter Lexicon. And once again, we're going to go wandering through a little bit of the Harry Potter canon and poke around and see what we can find. Quick thank you again to Harry and the Potters for letting me use the music for the opening. This is being recorded on July 7, 2011, and I have to say, this is a pretty exciting moment in Potter history. We're looking forward to about a week from now the final Harry Potter film coming out. And I was just thinking about that today. I was looking at the premiere. I was in London yesterday. There's so many activities going on. There's restaurants doing Harry Potter specials. There's film festivals going on. It's exciting to see it all happening, and a little sad to think this is it. This is the last time we're going to be doing this. Maybe we'll see what happens. I don't know about everybody else, but there's been a number of film clips coming up on the web, and part of me was thinking, no, don't look, but eventually I watched them, and oh, man, I think this is going to be the most amazing film. I'd love to talk about it, but I'm not going to, because I know for some people they'd rather not have any spoilers at all, but let me just say, this is going to be absolutely spectacular. The one thing that I'm kind of thinking about, I'm trying to figure out whether the first time to see it, whether to see it in 2D or 3D. And maybe some of you, it's an automatic, oh, 3D, it's got to be that. But honestly, I don't know. I'm thinking about 2D. It seems to me the colors are always better. But I don't know. We'll see what happens as we're coming up to that, to the final week here. And, of course, for me personally, I said I was going to read all the books. I know a lot of people do this. I was going to read all the books before this last film came out. I'm just about done with the first one, so chances are I'm not going to finish all of them. And here's why, is because I started reading the first one and chugging along, and I haven't read it, as I said, for, I don't know, close to a year. And just re-encounter that language and that story and just be thinking about it. And I didn't rush. In fact, I kept kind of going back and thinking about things. And some of what I've talked about in the last couple of podcasts has been just some of the things which struck me as I was reading. And so I'm still not done with book one. And it's funny because I don't know, some of you maybe know, I was working on another book project, which was basically notes on each chapter and each section of the books. So I was reading through some of what I'd written and some of this, the details and things. And some of that just opened up new thought processes and trying to figure things out. We were talking about the Quirrell question that was the last episode, and just trying to kind of think through what exactly that was. And there's just all sorts of things like that have been coming up. And so I've been reading slowly through that. We'll talk about some of that, too. We're going to talk about book one a little bit more. And then I've also been getting ready. I have the presentations I'm doing at the Grapevine Library here in Texas on the 16th, and I've been kind of getting ready for that. One of the two presentations I'm doing is on herbology, and I've only done that presentation two times. Once was here with the DFW Harry Potter fan group a couple of years ago, and then I also did it at Azcatraz. So that one I need to kind of go through and double check and make sure I'm still kind of up to speed on all of that. The other one is the Welcome to the Wizarding World, and I've done that on quite a few times, and I think I've got that one pretty much. I still have to go over it a few times, but I think I'm pretty much set there. And then, of course, a couple of weeks from now, we've got Pottermore coming up, at least the initial July 31 opening for the Select Million, which I'm certainly hoping million is a big enough number that I get to be included in that, but we'll see. Oh, man, I cannot wait for that, I'll tell you. So this is a wonderful moment to be at, all this great new Potter stuff just about here. So I'm just enjoying it, getting excited about Harry Potter. I just got on Google Plus and started a fandom circle on there with a bunch of fellow fans, and that's fun too. I was just chatting with somebody or kind of writing back and forth, that kind of hoping for that to turn into a chance to just have some good fan conversation and things. If you happen to get on Google Plus and want to get find me on there, by all means, I'll put you in my fandom circle and we'll just start getting some conversations going. So, well, chugging ahead. You know, it's funny, when I started this, as I've said a couple of times now, I started when I was looking at the Lexicon book, And just kind of was realizing that just reading some of these entries brought back memories of things in my 10 years, 12 years of being a Harry Potter fan, some of the places I've been able to go and the things I've been able to do, and how much, you know, some of that, it's just fun to have an opportunity to share that. And last time I was talking a little bit about some of the sources that we used. I wanted to talk a little bit more about that, especially the idea of what is canon. There's quite a nice page on the lexicon talking about that. And we get into some discussions about that, about what counts, what is officially Harry Potter canon and what isn't, why is it not just the books, for example? Why is it not include the films in a lot of people's opinion? And other people would say, well, of course it includes the films. It's all Harry Potter. So I just kind of want to quickly say a little bit of why I would consider certain things to be canon, and maybe also a little bit of an idea of why there's a little bit of a kind of a levels to canon, if you will. First of all, I guess the number one source of canon is... well, J.K. Rowling, of course, but the books, of course, the novels, the seven books, are the number one source of canon. And it's interesting because some people say, well, you know, my idea of canon is the original British editions. And I would say that's true for the first four books. The original British editions are the way, you know, Rowling, I guess you could say, originally wrote them. Although, you know, everything gets edited. But the later books, and I think it started with five, and I'd have to double-check this, but I think so, it was not a matter of there was the British edition, and then somebody at Scholastic went through and fixed it and changed it and made it so that we Americans could understand British terms or anything like that. But actually it was a kind of a three-way editing process between Rowling, who, of course, wrote the initial, you know, draft they were working with, and then editors from both Scholastic and from Bloomsbury. So the three groups all worked together to do the editing, and that's the way it worked. So yes, they are, the two editions, the British and the U.S. editions, are not identical, but by the same token, all the editing on both of them was kind of a mutual agreement by all. It wasn't, you know, somehow the American version is some sort of, you know, lesser version, at least on the later books. It is interesting, too, if you know that in 2004 there was a series of corrections made to the first set of books, and that was right when the first kind of adult covers came out. They did these, I don't even know if all of these corrections have been included in current Scholastic editions and things like that, but I know that there is this 2004 update where the corrections were made to a lot of the text, and a lot of it was just minor stuff, but there were a few things which corrected things which were the wand order thing in Goblet of Fire, of course, is a big correction, but also things like in book one, originally it said that Hagrid said at the end of the night on Privet Drive when they were dropping off Harry, Hagrid said, "I'm going to bring Sirius his bike back." Well, that got edited to, "I'm going to put this bike away," because since that first book was written, Rowling had written book three, and the whole kind of details of the story of what happened with Sirius and Wormtail, all of that kind of coalesced and came together, and therefore the phrase "bring Sirius his bike back" didn't seem to quite work as well. There were other things like that too, which were just changes which came about, and a few mistakes. Nearly Headless Nick said that he hadn't eaten in almost 400 years. That was in book one, whereas in book two he's having his 500th death day party, which of course fans didn't, you know, tried very hard to kind of rectify those two statements years ago, and then of course the editing happened, and the phrase in book one was changed to say, "I haven't eaten in nearly 500 years," and everything worked. So there's still some inconsistencies and so in there that need to be addressed, but a lot of it got taken care of in that 2004 update. So if you are curious, I think the lexicon, we do have a lot of those updates and changes and everything noted. If you go in into the individual book links and you read what the information that we have there, we have that. We also have some listings of the differences between the British and the American versions of the books, which is interesting too. And I guess for that matter, on the lexicon, we also have our Strictly British, which is a kind of a glossary of British terms and what they mean for Americans. You know, some of them we know quite well. You know, we know that a lift is an elevator and things like this. But then there's also things like an airing cupboard is mentioned, which we would say linen cupboard or linen closet in the United States. And so there are things like this which are just interesting if you read the books and want to kind of check that out. It's a good way to kind of make sure you're up on some of those. And it is interesting, you know, those of us that were reading the books all along, by the time we it's really obvious by the time you get to the seventh book, most of those Britishisms are not changed. I guess they figured at this point that we were all cottoning on and figuring it all out, and so we were fine. So that's just a little bit on sources. So the novels are kind of the number one source that we have. Then after that, the other books that she's written, Quidditch Through the Ages, Fantastic Beasts, some of those, there are some minor inconsistencies between those books and the novels. After that would come interviews where she's spoken directly, answered questions about facts about her created world. And I guess every author, you wouldn't necessarily take their interview statements as being the same as the things that they've written, but in the case of the world that she created, clearly she had these things worked out in advance, and they are, in her mind, part of the whole package, if you will. It's just stuff that she didn't have places to put into the books, but they're certainly on the same level. And you can see that now if you look at the things we know about Pottermore. A lot of that information is now being made available, and she does not look at it in any way as lesser information. It's just all part of the same larger world that she created. So things that she said in interviews and things like this are also included as sources. And other things that we know that she created, including those Daily Prophet newsletters that I talked about in the previous episode, and the famous wizard cards, which we'll talk about, not today, we'll talk about those in another episode, I think, and just kind of go through some of that. But all of those, since we know that she specifically and directly and intentionally wrote those and created them, those are considered part of canon too. But I guess, and this is where the levels come in, the cards and things like this don't always match up exactly with the books, and there are errors or inconsistencies, and the card for Bowman Wright, for example, lists his birth year as I think it's 1492 or something like that, whereas the Golden Snitch was created by him according to Quidditch Through the Ages in the 1300s, which so they don't match up. So everything doesn't exactly fit, but so I guess the levels are the novels come first, and then those other sources are just as much canon, but if there is a disagreement between those and the novels win out, I guess you would say. And the same would be true for interviews and things. So that's kind of the order of canon. The overriding rule is, did it come directly from J.K. Rowling? And if it did, then we consider that to be canon. People will debate that. They'll say, well, you know, we don't consider her interview stuff to be canon, because some of it is, you know, doesn't fit. It isn't correct. You know, her statements about Charlie Weasley's age, for example, don't work. Even when she tried to fix it by making another statement later, it still doesn't work with comments with lines in the books. And we'll talk about that at some point too. But essentially we go with canon with the things that we know are specifically from her. And then that precludes or excludes the films, because even though she has, as she put it, they're allowing her a lot of input, which I find a bit rich, you know, that they're going to allow her quite a bit of input. But she basically let them do what they wanted to do. She basically let them make the film. She figures they're filmmakers. This is their medium. They know how to do this. They know how to tell a good story, and let them you know, stay out of the way and let them do it. And it is interesting to me that she doesn't or didn't correct some things which would seem to be pretty simple fixes. For example, the films, they say Voldemort with a T on the end. And she said in an interview back in 1999, this is with the Orange County Register, she said somebody asked her, is it Voldemort or Voldemort? And her response was, I say Voldemort, but I'm the only one. Now, okay, she might be the only one, but she's the one that gets to say. You know, why doesn't she say, they say Voldemort, but I want to make sure they do it right, because it's Voldemort. Even now, if you listen to interviews with her, and when she says Voldemort, she says Voldemort. She doesn't pronounce the T. Yet they do pronounce the T in the films, and, you know, that seems to me she would have been something that she would have been able to say, no, it's pronounced Voldemort. And if, in case you didn't notice, if you listen to the audiobooks, Jim Dale, the U.S. version, Jim Dale said Voldemort until the films came out, and then all of a sudden he started saying Voldemort to match up. And I think that's really kind of too bad that the correct pronunciation that the author uses never got included, and now the whole universe thinks it's pronounced Voldemort when it isn't. So those are the kind of things that I kind of think, wow, I wish she would have said a little more and gotten her point of view in there. On the other hand, you know, they went to her with things. We're going to talk a little bit about the Black Family Tree today. And, you know, she was the one that came up with that when they needed a copy of that for the film. David Heyman emailed her, said, or called her and said, we need to have a copy of this because we've got to build the set. And a short time later, there it came, a fax with the whole thing written out. So they certainly did go to her, and she does what she always does, which is protect her story, which has always been what she has done. She's always protected her story, and I think that's great. We could go into a big, long discussion of whether the films successfully tell the story, but that's another whole question. Black Family Tree, as long as that came up, we might as well talk about that. Of course, reading the book originally, that was brought up, but you know, we didn't get all the names, and it didn't occur to us that we ever would until they were making the films. And sure enough, they're making this absolutely beautiful wall, which looks like a tapestry. It's actually just painted on the wall of the Black Family Tree. And I remember I was at the studio for the filming of the fifth film, and when we walked into that set, it was amazing. This is one of these things which I think every Harry Potter fan should have the opportunity to do this, because it's just so stunning to see this set. For one thing, they had the railing, the kind of the garden or park or whatever behind on the other side of the road. That's all built right there on the stage. And there's some greenery, but then there's a backdrop behind it to look like the woods and the trees and things. And so we actually started from there. We walked up to the door and then opened the door and walked down that hallway, which you see in Deathly Hallows Part 1, and of course in the fifth film as well, when you're walking down that long, dark hallway. And so we walk down there, and I can still remember that creepy feeling. This is just your absolutely classic haunted house looking set, long and dark. And of course, I'm right away looking for the portrait of Walpurga Black, and I'm also looking for the troll's foot umbrella stand. And sure enough, those things are there. Although there was no actual portrait in the frame, as I recall. I think it was just the frame, and it was covered over. But the one thing I really remember is walking up that staircase. For one, I remember there were still X's and tape on the stairs to tell people where they were supposed to stand for filming, which is a little jarring when you're in this. When you walk in this set, it really looks like you are in a haunted house of some kind. You just totally buy in, if you will. But walking up those stairs, it was so interesting because there were niches in the wall that had these elf heads in them. I don't think you really see it very well in the film, but as you're going up the stairs, partway up there's a curved landing, and then you keep going up, and as you're going, you see elf head after elf head, and then right on that landing is a window. And if you look out the window, there's again, it looks like greenery outside, and there's an elf head hanging outside the window, right in line with the ones that were in the cases on the wall. Of course, you never saw that in the film, but I remember walking up those stairs and seeing that that elf head hanging there, and then turning that corner and going up, and then there was this room with the black family tree, and oh man, I'll tell you, I had a little handheld digital audio recorder with me, and I stood there and just kind of read into my recorder all the names and the dates on this thing. Now we had already seen this thing from J.K. Rowling had released a hand-drawn version of it, so we had already seen it. But I was verifying because some of the dates we weren't too sure on. One or two of them didn't quite make sense, and as I read through them, I realized that we had gotten a couple of the dates wrong, and so that was nice because I got them fixed. But just to stand there and look at this and look at that, and it is painted on the wall, and to look at all of this detail, visually, of course, when you're reading it, you just imagine it being fairly plain. But the one that they did, of course, is very ornate and even had little images of people on it. And it is interesting too, because they, of course, had to expand it beyond what J.K. Rowling had done to make it a full family tree. So the other side, which stretches over onto the wall with the doors, had other names on it, which were, not. Not the names that are, in fact, they're very clearly not even, most of them are not even Potterish kinds of names. They're probably names of people, the set people, the special effects people. And so, because one thing you find out is that there's just an awful lot of inside jokes of names and little faces and things, which are all the people who work on the films that have their information is actually what's on there. So I don't know exactly who all those people were, but I do know that they didn't seem like they were, people who were part of the actual Black family, most of them. Wow, we're just moving right along here. I was looking at, again, and I like to kind of glance at the lexicon book and kind of find entries and just sort of think about them and talk about them. And one that struck me was the boil cure potion. And the reason that struck me is I'd just read that part in the Philosopher's Stone. And it struck me, you realize that you have to kind of get the timeline. You don't get this from the films, really. The very first potions class that Snape had them do was this boil cure potion, which one tiny mistake, and it melted a cauldron and splashed on poor Neville, who gets, has boils all popping out on his face. And it's just this horribly dangerous thing that Snape has them do. Flitwick, on the other hand, it isn't until Halloween that they're trying to levitate a feather. It's Halloween. It's 2 months into the classes, and his thing that he's having them do is levitate a feather. Just the difference. I mean, Snape on day one is having them create dangerous potions, whereas Flitwick, wonderful, sweet little Flitwick, is having them levitate feathers 2 months after starting class. Another thing that struck me, and this is also from book one, this is talking about Katie Bell. She is just a year older than Harry. So in that very first Quidditch match, when Harry is so nervous and can hardly eat and is terrified, and Katie's in her first Quidditch match as well. And what happens? Shortly after the beginning of the match, she gets hit in the head with a bludger. We think about her as being sort of older and more experienced and everything, but this poor girl was also going through her very first Quidditch game and didn't fare so well. She did have quite an experience too. So it's one of those things where when you start to think about it, you realize that there's a lot of dramas and stories and things going on all around Harry that we never hear about. One other thing. This is somebody. This is from the Daily Prophets. I'm going to read this. This is actually from the first one of the four Daily Prophet newsletters, and this is on the letters page. And I just have to read this because this is. A hag who writes in, her last name is Black and her first name is Annis, and if you are anyone who knows much about British folklore, you're going to recognize that name. This is what she writes. Dear sir, I am sick and tired of reading what horrible creatures hags are. You'd think, from recent articles in the Daily Prophet, that we spend all day luring innocent children into our caves and eating them raw. I am a hag, and I am deeply hurt by your false and vicious assertion that I am nothing but a flesh-eating monster, when I spend most of my days writing poetry, crocheting booties, and tending my shrubbery. If any of your readers need a babysitter, incidentally, I can be reached care of the cave, Deadmarsh. And that's signed Annis Black. And I find that funny because Black Annis is actually a creature, a terrible, horrible creature from British folklore. Another one of these boogeyman creatures which was used by parents to frighten their children into, behaving and obeying and things like this, who was said to be like a hag and fond of eating children and things like this. I'll put a link on the show notes for this page to a link about Black Annis. And so that's just one more example I was mentioning last time about how Rowling uses these references to folklore and things as if when we Muggles talk about them, we are just talking about some little glimpse of the wizarding world that has come through. So that's another one that's come through there. I just find that fascinating. I love that stuff. And I also love the Daily Prophet newsletters and the humor, you know, typical Rowling tongue-in-cheek humor that she uses. Oh man, we're getting to the end of a half an hour. I've got all sorts of things in my notes here that I wanted to talk about. One thing I'm going to bring up very quickly before we finish up, couple more tiny little notes from Philosopher's Stone. One of them is the only time we ever hear the Bloody Baron talk at all in the entire series is in book one, and it's not really him talking; it's Harry when Harry pretends to be the Bloody Baron and sends Peeves off by talking in a husky voice and things like this. And so and one other thing before we wrap it up for this time around, Dumbledore's chocolate frog card, one of the things on there that has brought up a lot of questions is the fact that he worked on alchemy with his partner, Nicholas Flamel. And people have said, well, how can that be? Nicholas Flamel was working on his Philosopher's Stone 600 years ago. Dumbledore must be 600 years old. But see, it doesn't say he worked on the Philosopher's Stone with him. It says he worked on alchemy. Now, it is true that the whole purpose of alchemy, more than anything, was to create the Philosopher's Stone. That was kind of its holy grail, its main goal. But that doesn't mean that that's what Dumbledore was doing by any means. He wasn't working on the stone, obviously, because he's not that old. He was actually born in 1881. So that's one thing. And the other thing, it says that his interests, he enjoys chamber music and 10-pin bowling. And, you know, I just read that and goes past, but the irony of those, the kind of the difference between chamber music, which is kind of a highbrow kind of a taste in, small group of musicians performing, you know, very lovely classical kind of music, and 10-pin bowling, which is, you know, you might consider a little bit more common, if you will, which is, you know, basically like what we in the States would call bowling, which is rolling a heavy ball down an alley trying to knock down pins. And I'm just trying to imagine Dumbledore at his age, at this point he's 120 years old or 110 years old, and hard to imagine him still out there bowling, but apparently that's what he likes to do. Oh, man, I still have so many things. I've got whole pages of notes here that I'm going to have to move over to the next episode. One of the things I want to talk about is I had an email from someone who was, I found very interesting. Their email said, basically, why do you think that J.K. Rowling put the character of Luna in the movies or in the films? And I think, she didn't. She put Luna in the novels. But that really got me thinking about all the novels and the way that they fit together, why certain characters appear in certain places in the novels. And I think that's something we're going to talk about next time, because I think it's really interesting to look at the series of novels kind of in that way, and why characters appear when they do and how they fit into the whole story. So we'll talk about that next time. And a lot of other things, I'm sure, too. But I guess we better wrap it up. Thank you for joining me as I meandered somewhat aimlessly around Harry Potter canon once again. As always, you can go to the Harry Potter Lexicon website, which is www.hp-lexicon.org, and find a lot more information. If you go to that URL then slash podcast, you can see the show notes for this particular episode. If you want to contact me, I'm at steve.lexicon@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at @lexicon_Steve. There's a Facebook fan page. I'll have the link to that on the podcast page. And don't forget, on the 16th of July, the talk's coming up, the Welcome to the Wizarding World and the Herbology talk will be at the Grapevine Library in Grapevine, Texas. So check that out. I'll put a link on the show notes as well for that, just to give you a link to the library website, which shows some details on that. But I also talk about it on the fan page and things. So I guess that about wraps it up for this time. This is Steve Vander Ark for the Harry Potter Lexicon podcast, and thanks for listening.